The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So thank you. It's good to practice with you, and thank you to everyone, for you all, for sitting and practicing. And Kevin, Julie, editing, maybe others too. Nancy scheduled me. The website people, the managing directors, the board of directors, the volunteer coordinator. Oh my goodness, it keeps going, right? Yeah, it's beautiful. Thank you. So if one were tasked with creating a religion, writing the holy books, right, be a very tall order. You would have to write with two considerations in mind: how will you be read, but also how you will be misread. You'd have to guard against misreadings that would legitimize bad stuff. And part of the Buddha's genius, to my mind, is that his set of teachings provide very few footholds for fundamentalism, very few footholds for the derangement of overconfidence. It's an incredibly nuanced path where, in a way, usually rhetorical force is not privileged over nuance. And so one factor balances other factors, and we can't kind of fetishize any one aspect of the path. That's what I've been highlighting this week, just with pairings of teachings that maybe are not even traditionally paired, but on my own path of practice have been important counterbalancing forces. And so with the last pairing I'm highlighting, that been circumambulating often these past couple of years, of compassion, equanimity. So we talk about freedom and happiness and these things, but a huge part of our practice is actually experiencing dukkha, experiencing suffering with incredible vividness. And part of why we don't squirm is we're developing okayness with imperfection, but part of why we don't squirm is so that we might perceive suffering vividly. And in a sit for a, this morning in a retreat, in a sense, it's just for pretend, right? If we're on retreat and there's a lot of suffering or something, we could shift postures. We could skip the sit. We could leave the retreat. But we don't. We don't. And we stay. And this begins to actually etch into our brain just how hard it is to be human, just how intense it is, just how intense even a very blessed life is. And we see the movements of our mind, the ways that it desperately seeks somewhere, someone to pin the blame on when suffering is intense. Maybe it's blame on someone else, maybe it's blame on the self, but it seeks to like hang the intensity of that affect somewhere. But we don't. All the blaming really just kind of blunts the insight about the intensity of the human condition, insight into dukkha, which is a huge, huge part of the path and has huge liberatory potential. And so, what happens to our heart when we open in that way, vividly to suffering, undefended? Well, first we sense how deeply we long to be happy, the kind of innocence of that wish. And we sense how deeply that's shared by others, no matter how different their nervous system is from our own. It can't be that different. It can't be that different. And so we dedicate some portion of our energy to alleviating suffering. How much is enough? Don't know. It doesn't matter that much. We start. We start. Marx said, from each according to their ability, to each according to their need. And we don't need a kind of authority or government to make us honor that. It's Sila. So we look to see where we can spend our love well. I'm sort of like a value conscious person. I am sort of not stingy, but value conscious, And it's like, and so I look like, okay, where can we get a lot of bang for the love buck, basically? Where can we spend our love well? Compassion entails a willingness to grieve. One element of compassion is grief. That's maybe the first movement of the heart, but that's not the last word. The last word of compassion is love. Matthieu Ricard says, like, in giving compassion instruction, says something like, imagine the suffering of the other, basically in incredible vividness until it's unbearable. And then there's this inflection point when it becomes unbearable to open to that depth of suffering. You pour all of your love into them. And sometimes it feels like if I open to compassion, it's going to end in suffering. It's going to end in suffering rather than love. But maybe compassion only ends in suffering when it's not counterbalanced by equanimity. And so we grow in our strength so that we can love more deeply. Our love becomes stronger. But even when our heart is very strong, vast, love is at some point becomes fatiguing. Michelle McDonald talks about flowers a lot, nature generally, and flowers a lot. And she's like, yeah, flowers open, but they don't expect to stay open. Sometimes I found myself prying open orchid. I know that's so bad. That's so not Buddhist. But flowers open and then something has to happen. They have to close, right? But what's the closing of the flower of the heart? It's not apathy, it's not hatred, It's maybe something like equanimity. Equanimity. Equanimity is about refining our relationship to helplessness. Refining our relationship to helplessness. The kind of helplessness is sort of, in a way, kind of foundational experience, primal experience. It's the experience that made us howl as children, and it's the experience that still generates tears as adults now. And it is that which our entire body is oriented against. It is the experience that is almost unbelievable to the willfulness of the ego. Nothing to be done, no moves to make, the ego all out of moves. So, do you mean ungovernable for real? Yeah. And so, aging, sickness, mortality, kind of narcissistic wound, the kind of limits of the ego's willfulness are highlighted. And so part of purifying our love is deeply understanding helplessness, which may be in the end just a synonym for dukkha. And so we ask the question, can we keep our heart open, relaxed, exquisite on the other side of our power? Can we keep our heart open on the other side of our power? Equanimity is love in the face of the endless ungovernable nature of samsara, the suffering of this realm. But it's not a closing. Equanimity it's a very quiet kind of love. It's like the arousal system, joy or something, very high state of arousal. Equanimity, the arousal is the system is kind of like turned down towards zero, but the heart is still wide open. And one of the functions of this quiet love is that it refines out maybe the impurities in our compassion, the grandiosity or the compulsivity or this kind of simple intolerance of suffering that masquerades as compassion, but is not it. That's something that I know well, in the face of loved ones suffering. It's a kind of intolerance and an agitated effort to dispel it, right? But compassion is a kind of, it may be urgent, but it's patient. It is equanimity that lets us rest when there's no action to take. It lets us rest when only rest is helpful. It lets us rest when only rest is helpful. And then compassion is born again. Then there's something to do, and we do something. These cycles of love and rest, love, and rest. The rest purifying our love, the love justifying the rest. And we keep going.